So it is lovely to join you in this podcast about the latest updates in the treatment of endometrial cancer. 2023 has been the year of uterine cancer. And as we focus on new practice-changing data that's come out of the SGO, ASCO, and ESMO, we have a star-studded cast of key opinion leaders who are going to put this into context for us. We'd really like to say a big shout out to the supporters of this. Continuing medical education is essential. And so for Merck and AstraZeneca to support this podcast is fabulous. Thank you. And starting today with Matt Powell, it is very exciting to have him. There is no one better to really set the scene for all of this exciting change. So Matt Powell is the Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Chief of the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at WashU, Chair of the NRG Uterine Corpus Cancer Committee, a top doctor and a good friend. Matt, I'm going to start with a quick story. So the 50th SGO annual meeting, 2018, I was trying to explain about endometrial cancer and Matt saved the day. We'd flown to Hawaii and I was jet lagged and like completely incapable of stringing words together. And this erudite clinician from the floor at the microphone led us through the right management of lymph node positive disease, which has really changed. So exciting change. Matt, what brought you into the field?
So in the field of oncology in general, or are we talking GYN oncology?
And yeah, uterine cancers.
Yeah, so uterine cancer. So I started here at Washington University in 1999. In the laboratory of Dr. Paul Goodfellow and David Much. And we were interested in mismatch repair at that point. DNA methylation, I had been doing as part of an MD PhD program and got really excited about mismatch repair and its link to Lynch syndrome, or what we called at that time hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer syndrome, which I'm so glad we use Lynch now. And so we started to understand the biology of endometrial cancer. Back then, we knew P53 mutations existed, but it's taken 20 plus years to put it all together.
Super. So 10 years since the Cancer Genome Atlas reported on endometrial cancer. So put it into context for us, the information that's gone into the PORTEC and the upcoming RAINBOW study.
Yeah, so, you know, the TCGA, again, like you mentioned, 10 years ago, we learned that there was really kind of four major categories of endometrial cancer, the polymerase epsilon group, which we didn't know much about at the time. We rarely find it outside of the uterus. It's somewhere between 5 and 10% in the uterus because it really interacts well with the immune system. So you don't see it escape the uterus very often. And then there's the mismatch repair deficient, or what we call MSI high. That group represents about 30% of the cases when we just look at new surgeries. And then we have the P53 mutated. And then the common type, or what we call NSMP, or non-specific molecular pattern, or copy number low. And I like to call it the common type because it's about half the cancers, at least, are the NSMPs. And what's evolved over time is trying to understand, what do we do to treat patients at high risk for recurrence? Is it pelvic radiation? Is it vaginal radiation only? Is it chemotherapy or a combination of all those? And what the PORTEC series of studies have done has shown us really vaginal brachytherapy is probably as good for most patients as whole pelvic radiation. So we've narrowed that toxicity. But there's still a group of patients that do poorly, and that's where PORTEC 3 came in, giving pelvic radiation and then adding chemotherapy to that. And PORTEC 3 showed us there were several groups that seemed to benefit from chemotherapy. The main one is the P53 group and the node positive group. So P53 tends to be our serous cancers. So that was quite exciting that we could kind of hone in on which patients benefited. Now, the mismatch repair group did not seem to benefit from the addition of chemotherapy. And the NSMP group also just had a very modest benefit from chemotherapy. So challenging that. And at the same time, we were running GOG-258. Which kind of had the opposite approach, where everybody got chemotherapy and half the group was randomized to get radiation. We just completed the molecular data on that, and it's really interesting because the trial itself showed no difference. And in order for you to find something interesting, you have to help one group and hurt another group. And that's what we found. It really looks like you helped the NSMP group, giving them radiation, and probably hurt the DMMR group. Now, this is hypothesis generating because we didn't know these things when we started the trial. So we'll have to test this. But it does look like probably we hurt the immune system when we give radiation to the DMMR patients and probably the POLE patients, honestly. So we're learning quite a bit here. And this is just 1 week old data that I've been excited to tell everybody for the last 2 months, because that's how long it takes for us to get these presented. The molecular classification, we use PROMIS, and that's a classification of four types. But I really think there's probably 10 or 12 types of endometrial cancer. Mm. When you add in beyond just the four groups, you add in the ER receptor. You add in what type of P53 mutation. So there's gain of function and there's loss of function P53. And they probably behave differently. We also have the whole HER2 story. So HER2 positivity really is a whole new avenue. We've known it's prognostic. And I think there was a nice paper by Dr. Britt Erickson showing if you have a serous cancer that's stage one and you look at the HER status, those that are HER2 positive, about 50% of the time they recur, even when you give them chemotherapy. If it's HER2 negative, only about 14 to 20%. So it's dramatic differences if it's HER2 positive. And so we've gone down that pathway of, can we target HER2? And we'll get to that in a little bit, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I think I'll stop there and see if you have questions about what we've just talked about or things that I should clarify.
Yeah, I know. And so when you think about the patient with metastatic disease, say the dostarlimab approval in the deficient mismatch repair patients, paclitaxel, carboplatin, and dostarlimab, how tempted are you in the lower grade endometrioid tumors to give the pembrolizumab on its own, like Dave O'Malley did in his phase 2?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And we're still trying to sort out what's the individual contribution of chemotherapy and checkpoint inhibitor, because we have second and third line data that, you know, shows about a 45 to 50% response rate in that defective mismatch repair group. We have trials ongoing right now. They're looking at checkpoint alone versus chemo. We don't have one that's really checkpoint versus chemo plus checkpoint yet, and that's being designed. Mm-hmm. I think there may be something to that addition to chemotherapy. So right now I'm a little nervous about de-escalating. And mm-hmm. there are some trials out there. For the dostarlimab, it's the Dominica trial. And then there's another pembrolizumab trial also looking at single agent checkpoint versus chemotherapy. A few things that we've learned is you might have to have tumor present in order to educate the immune system. We have a trial that's it's matured all the patients called GY020. Which is the earlier stage patients, so high intermediate stage 1 and 2. So pretty high risk of recurrence, 20 to 30% risk of recurrence if we do nothing. Those patients are given checkpoint per year versus observation. It may not work. We may have to really rethink what we're doing there. And that's some of these issues. Why the most common thing we see is early endometrial cancer that has 1 or 2 positive lymph nodes. We see that in our practice all the time. Right now, we don't have a trial for those patients because we've only included the more advanced patients. They were included in GY018 and the RUBY trial, which you just mentioned. And the RUBY trial showed us giving checkpoint inhibition with chemotherapy significantly improves not only progression-free, but we now know probably overall survival. Those data aren't released yet, but there's a press release about that. We have, in the DMMR group, a 60% improvement in overall survival. And we just learned in the P53 mutated group, a 60% improvement or 59% improvement in overall survival. That was presented at ESMO meeting and again at IGCS by Dr. Mirza. There's still a lot to be learned. As I mentioned, we want to get PROMIS Plus. We want to know HER2. We want to know ER to help us really hone in on which patients are benefiting. And I would say what was just as important, it did not look like the NSMP patients that have advanced stage measurable disease benefit from checkpoint. So we probably need a different strategy for those patients. And as I mentioned, radiation seems more important for that group. And I would guess we're going to really focus on estrogen and hormonal-based strategies for that group. It's really, think of it as ER-positive breast cancer.
Yeah. In RUBY, the PFS advantage, that's a hazard ratio of 0.77 in that group, the NSMP, 20% up to 31% at 2 years in terms of progression-free survival. That's a 50% improvement. So with the right therapy, it's really possible that different cocktails of things may really show the benefit of immunotherapy. There are a few other people who could have a perspective as eloquent as yours, given that you are the only, I think, person on the two publications that came out in March with the presentations at SGO. So nobody is better poised to compare and contrast GY018 and the RUBY study. So give us a high-level view of those two trials.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I was senior author on both of them, co-senior authors on 018. Dr. Agajanian was a champion in getting that trial open and ran. And obviously, she did more work than I did. She's the right place as the final author on the paper. And Dr. Eskander did an amazing job on 018. But it was really a different study in that we had two separate cohorts, the DMMR and PMMR, both powered to show clinical meaningful differences. We did. One thing was we required if you had prior chemotherapy, it had to be a year, a full year before you could go on this on 018. For RUBY, it was 6 months. And that does drive some differences within the two trials. On the RUBY trial, we allowed carcinosarcoma. And that was a bold gamble. We capped it at 10% accrual, but it really looks like it paid off. That was a group of patients that have a significant benefit. We weren't guessing that it would have that much benefit, but it really looks like for carcinosarcoma, we should be considering the zastarlimab. Other than the statistical issues, RUBY was able to continue to accrue through COVID a little better than what we were able to do with 018. Actually, we stopped 018 for almost a year with some concerns from CTEP or the NIH about bringing people in for a placebo trial during COVID. So there was a lot of discussion about that. And, a lot of centers on the RIBI also closed during that time. But if you had an area where you felt it was manageable, that was still acceptable. So we learned a lot from juggling during COVID and all the other things. And it's just been exciting to see really a practice change for both studies. And then I joke, even my mom was impressed of two New England Journal articles in one day.
Well, God bless her that she's well enough informed to know how impactful that is. What's called Englefinger rule, anything that crosses the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine's desk that has to impact clinical care is supposed to go out in the next edition of the journals. Way back when Englefinger, a gastroenterologist, was the editor. But that still applies. I love it when these big, meaningful, clinically impactful studies are going to change the standard care. It's very exciting. And then the approval for the deficient mismatch repair, dostarlimab plus paclitaxel carboplatin. Give us a bit of a timeline on when we'll know the OS, and give us your perspective on how these subsets, when we're looking at overall survival, are really going to play out. When do we know that these are really effective therapies? Is PFS an adequate surrogate for the sort of key outcome of overall survival?
Well, the key on the PFS, those curves are completely flat in 1 year. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's not even additional events happening, which is pretty shocking when you look at the DMMR group. It completely levels out and you start to see, that curve is going to have an OS that's impressive because after 1 year, nobody else seems to be progressing. And we knew initially that hazard ratio on overall survival, well, in RUBY, had a p-value that looked awful statistically significant. It just, there wasn't a whole lot of alpha used there. But there is a press release that has been updated, and we'll see that in the next few months at a big national meeting. Okay. And I think we'll also learn more about the molecular types, as you mentioned, how it does in different groups. As I mentioned, we know it works in DMMR, and that was no surprise to anybody. I mean, as a single agent, you have a 50% response rate. We knew it probably would do well, and it has. The P53 mutated group and that hint in NSMP, we're going to learn more. Is it the NSMPs that are ER negative? Do they benefit? That's where the clear cells tend to fall. My guess is yes, we'll see some there, but we don't have those data ready yet.
And do you think other subsets, PI3 kinase, ARID1A, do you think more and more we're going to be splitting, not lumping tumors?
Well, I think you'll probably have TMB being a predictor. I'm not sure PD-L1 marker is going to matter much. Now, you did see it. We did see that a little bit in some of the other studies, especially if you use an anti-PD-L1 drug. The marker seems to be a little more perhaps predictive. In some of the other studies, we haven't seen that PD-L1 is predictive, but we're looking at that. We'll have that those data. We'll also see what is HER2 doing. Is that a story where checkpoint's important? Or should we move on to using the anti-HER2 drugs, especially with some of the very exciting ADC data we've seen recently?
Yes, very exciting. So we talked about the Ruby subsets that were presented at ESMO. I thought that was fantastic. Manso did a great job. And as you say, the P53 really looked like it was a hot contender for being important as that plays out.
Now, I'll make one comment there.
Yeah.
People have said, you know, the P53 looks a little interesting on that translational data, that the serous cases, there was a lot of them that weren't P53 mutated. And I think as we do whole genome sequencing, or whole exome sequencing is what was done here, you know, you have to figure out the calls that are made and those things. I'm kind of waiting for peer review to happen. I want to see the total methods. Even as an author on this, there's still some questions we have before I want to say this is the true answer, because I think, you know, there's kind of a rush to get these data out and we want to make sure it's all correct and right. So I think the peer review process is important here.
Cool.
So I'm not ready to change practice completely yet.
No. Right. Yeah. We will have
translational data out on 018, hopefully within the year. I think if both of them are very consistent, that tells a pretty good story. Both those hypotheses would look pretty compelling to change practice and treat the DMMR, treat the P53, and maybe do something different with the NSMP group.
Yes, I agree. One of the things that came out of GY018 that was really interesting was the methylation status. Do you want to tell people about that and your thoughts?
So what we were able to do is collect the methylation data from the sites. We also had a central assessment of mismatch repair. First of all, we showed that what we see in the community and what we see in a central lab look the same. I mean, very high concordance. So the information we're getting from our local immunohistochemistry is very similar. Now, there's been a lot of thought that the promoter methylated MLH1 maybe don't do as well as checkpoint as with the germline and somatic group. Now, we didn't have a lot of germline and somatic, so it's not powered really to make a difference. There is a trend that they did better, but it's not that big a difference. And most of what we see and we take care of is promoter methylated MLH1 that's driving this DMMR. So that's around 85% of what we see. So yes, it may be slightly better if you have a germline or somatic mismatch repair cancer, but it doesn't look like it's 100% versus 50% like we saw in some of the single institution series, the response rates. Yeah. And kind of like we're seeing with rectal cancer, you know, rectal cancer is mostly germline and somatic and having these amazing responses. And I think that's one of the things we're thinking about. Do we need to give checkpoints sooner?
Yeah. So comment more about the presence of tumor, because the CR rates in some of these studies say that's a bit of a jump. But in cervical cancer, when Dr. Monk presented the data at ASCO as their first oral presentation, boy, the difference when you add immunotherapy, pembrolizumab, to combination 3-drug biochemotherapy, the CR rate really improved. And I wonder whether that is a marker for the sort of antigenic drive to the initiation of an immune response that then's maintained by your subsequent maintenance checkpoint.
Well, yeah, I would say, we presented that data on the 018 study and the CR rate went from 15% to adding checkpoint to 32%. So more than doubled. The overall response rate, 71% to 82%. But that CR rate, that's good you call that out. It's really impressive to see that complete response is happening. Even in the PMMR group, it went from 8 to 15% complete response. So again, they're getting chemo too, so it's always a little tricky to know, but it's certainly nice to see that improved complete response rate. Yeah. And it's coupled with PFS and OS and all the things we want to see, better quality of life. So it tells a pretty darn good story that we're doing the right thing to help these patients, but still want to know what's the right patient at the right time.
No, this is the year that it really started to happen. That's fantastic. Yeah. So comment, you already made the comment, those 18 patients presented at ASCO with rectal cancers, avoiding chemo radiation therapy, 100% response rate for the division mismatch repair colorectal cancers. And then at ESMO, there was a presentation by Dr. De Bruyne about neoadjuvant checkpoint inhibitor blockade in deficient mismatch repair. Slightly disappointing numbers. And do you think the methylation status is really the driver of that difference?
Yeah, you know, it's a little tricky because it's a short course, and does it just need more time? You know, there were responses in a short order. We had a similar study that we're actually doing, finishing up the translational science on it with 10 patients given checkpoint ahead of time, and they get 2 to 3 cycles and then they go to surgery. You know, I had a stage 4 clear cell endometrial cancer that had a complete response. We've never guessed, and she's now 6 years out from that study. Okay. We didn't give additional checkpoint afterwards. Now she did get some chemo afterwards, but you know, that study's going to be published here soon. So we really think that perhaps we may need to leave the uterus in for a little bit and give checkpoint to the right person when there's not bulk metastatic disease. As I said, most of what we see is a 3C1 condition where there's 1 or 2 positive lymph nodes, DMMR or PMMR. So 018 and Ruby are really a fairly unique population. It's a lot of recurrent disease, and it's a lot of patients that had kind of bulky metastatic disease. So, and it's nice thing is it worked there. We hope it'll work even better when you get the disease smaller, but we think you probably need to have disease there to educate the immune system.
Yeah.
And not hurt the immune system, radiation. Right. And full lymph node dissection. So I think you'll see even more push for less surgery and less aggressive lymph node dissections and such.
Interesting. You know, in melanoma, it's 2 cycles beyond CR. It looks like you might only need a year of pembrolizumab in the deficient mismatch repair patients. My typical practice is to do 2 years of immunotherapy for patients with metastatic disease, and PET CT scan, if nothing lights up, stop, or something lights up, biopsy it, see what it is. Many clinicians, it's checkpoint inhibitor for life. Do you have a bias in patients not on a clinical trial?
I think you have to tell them early your plan, because once they're on it and they feel well, they're scared to stop it.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, I think a lot of these patients that we started 4 or 5 years ago that we were, you know, bragging to our friends that we cured something we've never cured before, they heard that message and they don't want to stop it. But now I think saying, you have a very good chance of cure, we think probably a year or two after complete response is appropriate, but it's going to be really tricky to de-escalate when something works as well. Mm-hmm. And especially if the patient's not having financial toxicity, not having other toxicities, and they're having this 2-6 week infusion, they don't want to stop.
Mm-hmm. And in the Rainbow study, for those who don't know, redefining adjuvant treatment in endometrial cancer based on molecular subgroups, just a great trial. The only group that's getting de-escalated is the polymerase epsilon, the POLE.
Well, we're also de-escalating the NSMPs that are ER positive.
Okay.
So that's the second part called the taper. Can't remember if it's rainbow blue, but Jessica McAlpine's running that out of Canada, and we'll be opening that here in the United States. We thought a year ago, but it took that long to get the forms all to match and get all those things. But so that trial will be opening soon through the NRG, and that's called GY032.
032. So that's the orange group with the 2 years of hormonal therapy?
No, that's a different group. So that group's being done in Europe with hormonal therapy. Yeah. Now, there is a group that's the P53 mutated group that's looking at PARP inhibitor, but you know, I think that's a whole nother discussion whether that trial will continue after the French trial, the UTOLA trial. So I think we need to really, it's probably not all PMMR or all P53. It's probably P53 with an HRR signal. So some type of homologous recombination signal. And we'll learn these signals, I think, from Ruby Part 2, from DuoE. The translational science is developing. It clearly looks like we're helping some patients, but I don't think it's for everybody.
Right. So Ruby 2 with niraparib. Tell us about DuoE, because this is the year that DuoO was the first positive immunotherapy trial presented at ASCO. in ovarian cancer, and then Duo-E was a big splash at ESMO.
Definitely. And Duo-E and Dr. Shannon Weston, it was actually her young investigator project that turned into this wonderful trial investigating the DNA damage and repair in endometrial cancer and investigating checkpoint with durvalumab, the four-drug regimen, durvalumab, olaparib, carboplatin, paclitaxel, and then you had a durvalumab alone with the olaparib placebo, and then you had the carboplatin taxol with a placebo. So it was a three-arm study, very well done, powered, all the right things. Some interesting findings in that, the triple drug regimen did seem to do the best. And the this weird phenomenon of not seeming to help Asian patients, the checkpoint by itself, maybe a little bit of help when you had added the PARP inhibitor in. That was also consistent with the ATTEND trial. So there may be a lot more to this story as we look through this. And I know that's I've been saying that on every study, but it is one of those things where we have a tricky discussion to make and understand why certain patients benefit. I do think our African American patients, our Black patients, may benefit the most from checkpoint. They tend to have that P53 mutation, and maybe an immune microenvironment can really conducive to help from a checkpoint inhibitor. Now that's preliminary data. A lot of work needs to go into that yet.
And you sort of comment about ATTEND because they're both durvalumab and atezolizumab are PD-L1 inhibitors with quite exciting results.
Yes, it is exciting. And I think, that's where maybe a PD-L1 marker may be a little more important, but it's so amazing to have these four trials, plus it was a randomized phase two trial, putting this all together, the PARP randomized trial, EUTOLA, the neoadjuvant trial. I have tables that look all of these, and we really want good molecular analysis on all these patients. And it's, I just call it PROMIS Plus. And again, I mentioned that earlier, the PROMIS classifiers plus what type of P53 mutation was it, ER there and HER2 and TMB. I think if we have that in all patients, we can really sort out a little bit more information, plus adding in PD-L1.
So
So
everybody has a rare tumor with their
every,
unique sort of fingerprint.
just like breast and lung cancer, it's never as simple as just carboplatin.
So that's exciting, but challenging in terms of designing the right trials.
Yeah, I think it's it, I think we've seen the last of a single trial for all patients. And we and it
Good.
looks like we might even add in endometriosis-associated cancers into our queues, because they really are probably the same as endometrial cancer. So radical thinking here, subgroup analysis, molecularly driven care.
And the reason patients with dual primaries seem to do so well, it may absolutely be through the activation of immune, response in that sort of adjuvant of endometriosis inflammation. So, do you want to comment about EUTOLA, that just the size? And because one of the things that I find a little concerning about things, so that was what 140 women in the analysis that sort of really looked at outcomes. It's just impossible. It's too easy to draw a negative conclusion from a small study when things are complicated.
That's a very valid point. And I think that it was a bit enriched for P53. So I think the investigators kind of knew that they wanted to have that patient population in there. And again, it's an immature, just to draw large conclusions yet. We have RubyPart-2, we have Duo-E, and I think once we understand the biomarkers a little better, we can maybe understand what the right patient is to be receiving PARP, because it's clear that PARP has a role, but I'm not sure it's for everybody. I think the part that with EUTOLA that worried me is some of those overall survival curves were heading the wrong direction, and so I'm not ready to give it to everybody, and I want this data to mature much more before we make broad implementation of PARP inhibitors. I think we need to let these trials mature a little bit.
So molecular fingerprinting of tumors and the subclassifications of the different types really, I think, has really arrived. What about the new staging? Has that arrived at St. Louis as well?
So I sit on AJCC. Dr. Mutch sits on AJCC, my senior partner. Alex Holloway is a very good friend. 2023 FIGO has been wonderful in getting everybody talking about molecular staging. I think it's will take several years to implement it because we have to study each of those new data points and to see if they can even be captured and measured and write a SOP, a standard operating procedure for somebody with a eighth grade reading level to be able to extract it out of a chart and put it in there. I think it's complicated enough for you and I to figure out the stage. I'm not sure it's, I think, you know, Einstein always said, make it as simple as possible, no simpler. I think we have a little room to make it as simple as possible because right now they've really did a great job capturing a lot of the new stuff and trying to get a prognosis. But when we now have therapies that have a 60% benefit in areas, it changes everything.
Yeah.
So I think we'll probably not see FIGO 2023 enacted in the US through AJCC yet. And so sit tight.
Mm-hmm. That's helpful advice. I love the sort of non-aggressive, aggressive histology subdivision of things. I think that's potentially helpful. But as you say, the complexities of how you then choose treatment are makes it almost impossible to make that simple.
Yeah. You know, but WHO did low grade and high grade 2 years ago. So we could all embrace that low grade, high grade concept. So the grade one and twos being the low grades, because really the inter-observer error for grade two is so great. Low grade and high grade is probably the way to go. I think that's what you were referring to there, right?
The aggressive histologies, but you're right. I'd sort of just say the two groups, I think, is really helpful. Yeah. So the future, what are your predictions as we look to sort of the next series of clinical trials and redefining the future in the age now when immunotherapies arrived?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we have a dual immunotherapy project ongoing called GY025, looking at ipi-nivo. And maybe there are some groups that's going to need that. We often, when there's dual classifiers, so if they're DMMR and have a P53 mutation, we've kind of ignored that P53 mutation. That may actually be an important prognosticator of how they do with checkpoint. We used it as how they do as far as relapse, and it didn't seem to matter for relapse, but it actually may impact their checkpoint response and resistance. So as you accumulate what we thought are passenger P53 mutations, they might be drivers after immunotherapy or after chemotherapy. So let's keep an open mind when we think about subgroups in individual cancer. When we think we know something, we get surprised all the time. And I always like to say, I don't know what I don't know.
Yeah. And what's marvelous is that the sort of molecular and the sort of specificity of these new subgroups as we think about the disease, it has set up the platform for getting the answers that we can translate into each of our patients' treatment decisions. So thank you. And thank you for all you've contributed. And I think it's very exciting to see the benefits of all of the hard work, you know, careful thought and commitment to see scientific advances really translate into clinical benefit.
Matthew, I would say one of my problems, Richard, is I want to tell you what I'm thinking rather than keeping it simple and really trying to transmit the data. But you know, read Ruby, read 018, keep up to date, do OE. There's so much great literature out there.
Yeah.
It is hard to keep up with, but thank goodness we have these manuscripts to put in our journal clubs and learn from.
Yeah, fantastic. Good times. Parting thoughts, never a better time to be in GY oncology. Cinderella comes of age.
I would fully agree. You get so excited about all the stuff we have going on. So
good.
Thank you so much today.
Yeah, great to connect. Thank you. Dr. Powell.
Have a good day.
You too.